From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how one Milwaukee man is showing appreciation for the city's essential workers. Then we hear about how social media companies are balancing free speech ethics under coronavirus.
We've seen a lot of conspiracy theorists and fringe groups sort of pushing these inaccurate narratives online in order to draw attention to their views and get people riled up. And so that's created a real challenge for companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter.
Plus, our film contributor discusses what the closing of movie theaters during the pandemic could mean for their future.
Fox Bay in the Milwaukee area comes to mind, Avalon Theater, some of these beautiful historic locations that have been functioning quite well in recent years. I would say they're in danger.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The question of who and what is essential has become a top priority in our lives. While people in healthcare are working tirelessly to combat the spread of COVID-19, they have also shared the spotlight with workers we took for granted. There's the people working at the grocery store, mail carriers, janitors, and countless others that are doing essential work so that we can continue to have what we need while we are safer at home. Thousands of people across the country have put their creativity to use to help make masks and other PPE equipment to show their appreciation for essential workers. And one Milwaukeean decided the best way he could contribute was with a special t-shirt design. Bryce Smith is the founder of My MKE Apparel, a t-shirt business he runs out of his basement in his spare time while being a stay-at-home dad. What originally started as a way to make creative local designs for his son has turned into something much bigger. His latest design is a MK Essential t-shirt that he is creating at cost to help show appreciation and recognize all of the essential workers in Milwaukee. He joins me now and starts by explaining how MK Essential came to be.
Well, from the outset, we wanted to do our part to help mitigate the spread and to take care of our fellow Milwaukeeans. So we started sheltering in place back on March 14th. And then as you know, time was rolling by, I was just wanting to find a way to do more for folks. I heard the calls for face masks. And first I thought, oh goodness, okay, well maybe I'll try my hand at that, but I don't have a sewing machine. I have no idea how to sew. And even the people who do have sewing machines apparently are not finding it too easy to make these masks. So I felt, yeah, well, that's not my cup of tea. And I just kept hearing so many of my friends who are essential workers talking about, you know, their worries and their fears and going out there and doing their jobs. They were suddenly putting themselves and their families at risk, and they had never imagined doing so just by doing their jobs. And I just really felt for them and wanted to do something to help them while still doing my part by staying at home. And the idea of this particular shirt design just came to me. And I realized that, you know, this is a way in which I could help them. I couldn't necessarily, you know, keep them safe, but I could show them support and how much we all support them, and to basically, you know, help boost their morale and to show them that they're appreciated, and also to help create a sense of solidarity and pride. And just to try and put some good out there in the world amidst all the bad.
Definitely. And you mentioned that the shirt just kind of came to you. So was the design just an easy thing to lay out? And can you describe it for us for the listeners over the radio?
Yeah, it's funny. I wish, for starters, I got to say that this whole shirt design business is not something I ever envisioned myself doing. I've just never really considered myself creative in this way, but it seemed like around the first of the year, I started having various shirt ideas. And once I started coming, I just couldn't shut them off. So I've learned to just go with it and get them out there right away, because given that they seem to come from nowhere, they can disappear. It seems like too, and that's my concern.
Yeah, and it started with the shirt for your son, right?
Yeah, it did. because I actually had spent a year trying to find a shirt with a hop on it for him. He loves the hop. And I couldn't find one. And I finally realized, okay, well, I don't think I'm going to buy one to buy him. So I just, all right, I'll learn how to make him a shirt myself. So I figured out how to make one and made it for him. And yeah, it was so cool to be able to show it to him. Because when I did, you know, he kind of gasped and then he whispered and I said, "It's a beauty." And when he did that, I was just hooked. And then I had so many ideas for other shirts, you know, different designs to celebrate the places and things that we really love about living here in Milwaukee. And then with the MKE Essential design, I was just thinking a lot about the word essential, and it just seemed to kind of roll together, MKE Essential. And the MKE portion of the shirt, the way that it's designed is inspired by our city flag. And then also, you know, the rest of it is kind of like a stamp, like a governmental stamp, to make it look official. And, you know, just bold colors on the black. And it's been so cool to see the effect that this shirt seems to have on the people who wear it. You know, just, and it's an incredible feeling to know that you're able to give people something that they can kind of embody and project to the world, the sense of who they are, like, you know, that they want to wear this and that they feel so proud doing so, and that it tells the world something about them as people. It's really cool to be able to give that to folks. And I don't necessarily see myself as being in the t-shirt business per se, but more so the do-good business. So with my business model, I donate 50% of all profits to some of the institutions that really make life here great, like the Milwaukee Parks Foundation, and also the Wauwatosa School District, which is where our sons go. And then with the MK Essential shirt, there's no profit. I'm selling them for $5 a piece intentionally, which is the cost of materials to make them, because I want to make this accessible to as many people as possible, whether they're loved ones or your postal carrier or delivery people. It's just the coolest thing to hand one of these shirts to someone like that and to see their expression, the deep appreciation for recognition of who they are and what they're doing for us, and just that we appreciate them. It's amazing.
You've turned into a self-taught t-shirt designer. Did the demand that has come of it, even before MK Essential design came out, did that meet your initial expectations, or was it just something that you're like, oh, I'll give it a whirl, and now it's turned it morphed into something that you weren't quite prepared for, maybe?
Yeah, it's very much, hey, I'll give this a whirl, and just see, and, you know, just keep doing it as long as I can and learning as I go too. It's, I don't know, it's a great way to spend my time, although I don't have much of it. Admittedly, I'm not getting enough sleep. and I do ask folks who order shirts to be a little patient with me, because it's just me in my basement once our sons go to bed. Well, me and Bruce and Dolly. I've been listening to Bruce Springsteen and Dolly Parton a lot lately. I just find them both inspiring and reassuring at the same time. So I'll put them on my headphones as I'm making the shirts. But yeah, I've just been kind of figuring it out as I go along. And as long as there's a demand for it, I'm going to meet it. I just feel very, very lucky that I am able to help in this way. And I try to get to know the folks who buy them a little bit, if they're open to it, just to know where they're going. But it's also just neat to know that they're out there in the world and, you know, doing some good.
Has this shirt also been a way to help teach others what essential means?
Yes, I would say most definitely, especially as I've been talking to folks who are looking for ways to help, you know, to help them think in terms of, okay, we've got our essential workers. It seems everyone knows our healthcare providers who are on the front line. But the fact that, you know, our postal carriers are essential too. know, the people delivering your pizza, they're essential. The folks working in the grocery stores, all of our city workers, you know, you're essential. We've got so many people out there who are just essential to caring for our city and all of us. And it's nice to, yeah, to help educate people about what that means. And I feel like I've been educated too by the different people who are buying the shirts.
Well, let's hear from some of the voices of the workers who got these shirts.
My name is Jen. I am a registered nurse. I bought MKE essential shirts for my husband and me because we are both nurses and want to support businesses that are giving back to the community. As an essential worker during this pandemic, I worry about being at an increased risk of exposure and passing the virus on to my family. But what I hope can come out of this is a stronger sense of the importance of family and our communities. So please continue to social distance and stay safe and be smart out there.
Hi, my name's Katie. I'm married to an essential employee and my sister is an essential employee. I wanted to show them that I'm indebted to their bravery. And as a citizen experiencing this pandemic, I'm worried most about Milwaukee celebrating the end of the Shelter in Place Act too quickly. And as a result, we slide into a second round of COVID-19 cases later this year. However, I'm also in awe of the everyday kindness I now see all around me. I'm positive some of it was there before, but this new pace of life has also made me aware of how special this community is that we live in.
My name is Tess Halley. I am a daycare teacher. We are essential workers for the essential workers. I got a lot of Milwaukee Essential t-shirts for my fellow co-teachers to hopefully brighten up their moods. I also got a lot of shirts for my family members who are also essential right now, as they are nurses and grocery store clerks and they work in factories. I'm hoping that soon this will all come to an end and we can all return to our normal activities. Meanwhile, I'm hoping everybody is staying safe and doing what they can to help everybody else out.
My name is Todd, and during the whole COVID-19 realities, I came to realize that my upstairs neighbor, who just became a truck driver, is essential in a way that before he was just kind of a truck driver, and now he even realizes how important he is. And when I saw the shirts and I saw the fun of the shirts, I thought it was a fun way to acknowledge him and what he contributes. And it was fun. He thinks it's great. He loves the shirt.
Hi, my name is Ashley Bequest, and I'm a registered nurse at Children's Emergency Department and Trauma Center in Milwaukee. I got a Milwaukee Essential shirt for myself and some of my coworkers because we are very proud to provide care for the kiddos in our community and are dedicated to keep them safe during this pandemic. As an essential worker during this pandemic, I worry most about asymptomatically carrying COVID home and infecting both my husband and my 8-month-old daughter. What I hope can come out of this horrible virus is a sense of togetherness and empathy for each other, for our community to learn to love each other and respect each other again, as COVID has not only affected one of us, it has affected us as an entire city.
That was Jen, Katie, Tess, Todd, and Ashley from Milwaukee talking about why they got MK Essential t-shirts. And Bryce Smith, thank you so much for your time. And of course, all the time in your basement late at night that you're putting in towards making these for people.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, if anyone would like to order shirts, they can do so by going to mkeapparel.com. And if they would like to donate money, they can do so through PayPal at mymkeapparel@gmail.com. If they'd like to donate time or resources, they can email me at mymkeapparel@gmail.com. And also, you know, thank you for doing the work that you're doing, and also your mom. I know your mom's out there helping folks out too, serving lunches to kids. And thank you. And I hope that we don't lose anybody else to this terrible virus. I'm also hopeful because I feel like there are just so many people who are stepping up in ways that I never would have imagined. And that really gives me hope. If we can all do what we can with what we've got, that we're going to make it through this. And I just wish everyone and their families good health and everlasting love.
Bryce Smith is the founder of My MKE Apparel. You can see photos of people in their MKE Essential shirts at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we learn how social media companies are balancing free speech ethics under coronavirus. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In April, a local TV news station in Bakersfield, California, interviewed two immediate care doctors about their views on the coronavirus outbreak. Within days, the American College of Emergency Physicians and the American Academy of Emergency Medicine condemned the interview as, quote, reckless and their opinions untested. YouTube then deleted the video, which has millions of views, citing it as a danger to public health. And it's not the only video YouTube has deleted. A viral film claiming the virus is a hoax was taken down this week as well. This has led many to question social media companies' role as arbiters of free speech. Are they public forums, or are they media companies responsible for the real-life effects of the speech they empower? To discuss social media ethics, Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with Stephen Overly, a technology reporter for Politico.
As a tech reporter, a lot of what you do is follow the ways that tech companies, social media companies, interact with the law. You're based in DC. But as people are talking about the responsibilities that the government has to preventing the spread of the coronavirus, what conversations are being had among social media and tech companies with regards to their responsibility to preventing the spread of misinformation, especially when it's directly related to the spread of the virus?
Misinformation has been a rampant problem for social networks, both before the coronavirus pandemic and especially during the pandemic. We've seen a lot of conspiracy theorists and fringe groups sort of pushing these inaccurate narratives online in order to draw attention to their views and get people riled up. And so that's created a real challenge for companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter as they try to maintain networks that are positive and that promote accurate information without stifling the speech of their users, including their more fringe users. You've seen them go about that in a couple of different ways. You've seen pretty much all of the social networks promote accurate content as sort of a countermeasure to misinformation. So for instance, they will point users to the Centers for Disease Control or the World Health Organization or other reliable outlets for information related to coronavirus. Another step that some platforms have taken is to actually remove content that is inaccurate or could be harmful. You know, for instance, Facebook cracked down on organizers of protests in several states. So essentially, Facebook users were using the platform to organize in-person protests. And when Facebook determined that those violated state law, they went ahead and shut those down. So that's obviously a more tangible and an aggressive step, you could say, that Facebook and other social media outlets have taken.
And the perception there is that they're not only stifling people's ability to share information, but they're also preventing public assembly. So the argument that people are having is that it's an infringement on their constitutional rights, that Facebook shouldn't have, you know, limits on their free speech or on their freedom of assembly. But Facebook's also a private company. So how does that jive to these companies?
Well, these are private companies, and so they're not beholden to the First Amendment. But they certainly try to promote the free exchange of ideas and free speech on their platforms. But they really grapple with how to do that in a responsible way. You know, they want it to be an open forum, but they also don't want it to necessarily be a free-for-all. And so one of the lines you've seen companies draw is when online misinformation can lead to harm in the real world. That's one of the issues that's come up in these protests in many state capitals.
Which isn't too different than, for example, the Supreme Court's case law surrounding hate speech, where if you're causing someone to commit violence, that's not protected under the First Amendment anyway, even legally.
Right. You know, you sort of look at both the speech as well as the consequences of that speech. Certainly that's how these social platforms have often looked at these issues. And so when you have protesters assembling in state capitals, for instance, many of them are not wearing masks. Many of them are not observing 6 feet of separation. It does raise a real public health concern about whether those protesters, you know, their families and other members of the public could be exposed to coronavirus.
I'm wondering to what degree social media companies cooperate on these efforts. As was said in the introduction, there was a video of two doctors in Bakersfield, California, where they were disputing safer at home orders was deleted from YouTube, but was kept up on Facebook. So people were saying that what's the point of one platform deleting a video if another platform will allow that video, only to then alert people to download the video and then spread it through other means. So do Facebook and YouTube talk to each other, and have there been attempts at that?
It's a complicated answer because these are separate companies. They have separate terms of service that they impose on their users. And so they sometimes do come to different conclusions about what is and is not allowed. That's something that's been true during the coronavirus pandemic, but it also was true even before then. In other instances, though, you have seen the companies coordinate. So for instance, when it comes to removing terrorist propaganda, or when it comes to cracking down on foreign meddling in U.S. elections, you have seen a higher degree of coordination among the companies on those issues. It's not yet clear that they've done a lot of that when it comes to coronavirus, in part because you really just have so many different conspiracy theories and fringe groups all converging on this one issue that it kind of creates this perfect storm and this real challenge for the companies to respond to.
Now, some people have said that when social media companies curate and use community standards and take down content, that might provide a confirmation bias, that people are then more confident in a conspiracy that these companies are trying to say something that might not be factual but confirms their idea of a conspiracy. And when this has happened in the past, I'm thinking of 4chan, which became very popular among people who are meddling in radical politics, been connected to mass shooting events. And when 4chan, which presented itself as being a free-for-all, you know, in your words, began to crack down against this kind of speech, alternatives popped up, forums popped up, 8chan has become a popular alternative. Is there a fear for Facebook and YouTube that the more they curate content in a way that they believe to be in the public interest, not only will people think that they have some sort of biased ulterior motives, but will also lead to alternative websites where people can share misinformation, believing that they're doing so in a kind of free speech environment?
Large social media platforms, particularly Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, have been accused in recent years of harboring a bias, particularly a political bias from both political parties. So the loudest voices have been conservatives who say that Silicon Valley and these large companies based there are very liberal and they have an anti-conservative bias. And so when they decide to take down content or ban users, they're doing it through that lens. Similarly, you've heard arguments from more liberal and progressive lawmakers and groups say, you know, these companies sort of relent to conservative groups and are not as tough on some of this content as they should be. And so, you know, you're right that any decision these companies make sort of inherently will come with an accusation of bias, whether that's political bias or social bias, what have you. And that has driven some users off those platforms. You know, we've seen social media sites like Gab and Telegraph become forum for these voices that may be taken off of other social media platforms. But I think it is worth noting, you know, Facebook has more than 2 billion users. You know, YouTube also has a very large reach. Twitter reaches millions of users every month. So these are very large platforms, and therefore the policies that they uphold and the content that they allow really does have a very large impact compared to some of these smaller platforms that maybe are take a lighter touch to how they regulate speech.
That was Stephen Overly. He is a technology reporter for Politico. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now joining us for some context around the ethics of social media is Kathleen Bartson-Culver. She is the director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
No, I'm happy to be here.
So we spoke a little bit about the responsibility that platforms like YouTube and Facebook have to presenting content that users submit. But what kind of responsibility do those platforms have, perhaps maybe not only legally, but also ethically, to prevent hate speech and damaging content from being published there?
Well, I think one of the reasons that we talk so much about platform responsibility and what sets of ethics considerations they have, we focus on those conversations because they're aren't a lot of legal guidelines here. So these platforms enjoy tremendous protection under what's known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And 230 essentially means that if there's legal liability for people who post content on these platforms, but not for the platforms themselves. So they have pretty broad brush immunity. So for instance, if I were to defame you, Julian, in a Facebook post, you could sue me, but you couldn't sue Facebook. And so that gives them a lot of protection, and it means that we don't have a lot of legal recourse when people want to, want to go after something that's posted on a platform. You can go after the poster, but you can't go after the platform. And that's why we talk so much about what responsibilities they ought to have, because they don't have a lot of liability.
Now, I understand this law came about in the 1990s, and I imagine the context for that time before social media as we knew it was a little different. I imagine it had to do more with protecting communications utilities from bearing responsibility for what was said over, say, the phone or over a text message. But things have changed. So how do these social media giants see themselves with regards to being a communications utility versus being a for-profit company that wants content to be engaging, to keep people using those platforms to engage with one another and businesses and organizations they might like?
Yeah, I think a lot of people say, and I think it's a true statement, that the internet as we know it today would not exist if it weren't for those Section 230 protections. But I think it's important to remember that it wouldn't exist in the positive ways that we know it, and it wouldn't exist in the negative ways that we currently know it. So, you know, I do not think YouTube would exist without Section 230. It just would have been sued into oblivion. But that also means that hate speech and conspiracy theories on YouTube wouldn't exist either. So we've sort of, we gave those protections to stimulate innovation, and stimulate we did. You know, I studied the Communications Decency Act way back in the 1990s. I never could have imagined where we would be in 2020. But what's interesting about the, what we're talking about today is that you see some politicians and activists on the left and on the right today saying, maybe it's time we take a fresh look at Section 230. So for instance, in the case we're talking about with YouTube removing this video by these two doctors, Senator Ted Cruz came out shortly after the decision with a tweet that made direct reference to the Section 230 protections, that when you get this immunity from liability, you have to be careful with your tremendous power.
Well, of course, you know, Facebook, as I alluded to earlier, or YouTube, they know that people wouldn't voluntarily opt into those platforms if they were overrun with violence, hatred, perhaps misogyny. And so they have taken it also upon themselves, not because of the legal threat, but also as you know, good business people to begin to curate a lot of that content.
Yeah, I think they see it as corporate social responsibility. I think you see different platform leaders waking up to this at different times. I think one person I've really enjoyed hearing from is Susan Wojcicki from YouTube, and how seriously YouTube has tried to take these issues. I don't think with the current firestorm, she's probably having a very good week. But after the 2016 election, you saw someone on the other end of the spectrum at the time, and that was Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, who was, you know, pretty much denying that mis and disinformation on his platform really had any impact. And of course, it's impossible for us to prove one way or the other, you know, the impact that something has on an election that's already concluded. But I think, you know, in the early going, Zuckerberg was not, at least publicly, so focused on that level of responsibility. But I think Facebook certainly is there today, and they're trying to do much more to deal with problematic content on their platform.
Now, you'd referenced the ideological divide, and Senator Ted Cruz has said Facebook and YouTube are deleting things because they are of a different view than the mainstream, that people who post things on Facebook and YouTube have a different view of what's essential, of what role the government should have in maintaining public health. How does that sound to you, is just saying, well, it's just a different perspective, as opposed to, for example, as was the case in 2016, or as is the case now with people sharing conspiracy theories around the coronavirus, its origins, and the way it spreads, with saying it's just a different opinion?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of befuddled by that, by the ideological aspect to this. And, you know, I think we really run a risk of sort of labeling coronavirus conspiracy theories or coronavirus denial as being conservative. I just don't know that that comports with reality. So the idea that YouTube took this video down because it was in some way conservative, it just befuddles me. Honestly, I don't quite understand that perspective. What I think YouTube did here was make a decision to take down content that it thought worked against public health and could possibly be dangerous for people. Is that an easy decision? No. Might others have made a different decision, come to a different conclusion about it? Maybe, but I'm not seeing the leap from that into some sort of grand, you know, left coast attempt to censor conservative speech. You can certainly find a ton of it on YouTube and every other platform.
Well, the underlying assumption there is that Democratic governors, which have really come out strongly with public health guidelines, whether it be in Michigan, right, Governor Whitmer, even Governor Evers here in Wisconsin, in California, in New York, with some pretty strict orders about staying home, wearing masks, etc. And I think the assumption underlying some of these ideas and conspiracies is that Democrats kind of have an ideological preference for keeping people indoors, and that they're an oppressive kind of thing. So are you afraid that perhaps through deleting content, YouTube is offering a kind of confirmation bias in the sense that it's based in California and they have ideas of collusion?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that I think Mike DeWine in Ohio and Larry Hogan in Maryland would really disagree with the premise of that question. You know, those are two
Republicans. Yeah.
Two Republican governors who had some incredibly strong social distancing guidelines. And in fact, I think I was listening to Mike DeWine talking about the routine governor's calls that they have, you know, every day or every couple of days, and reflecting that if you didn't know the political affiliation of that attached to the voice that you were hearing, you wouldn't have been able to guess it. And I think that that's something that I get very concerned. One of my big ethics concerns is when we bring this this false left-right binary into something that is neither left nor right. So public health is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. It's an everybody issue. And to the extent that we bring partisan battles into this, it damages all of us. It doesn't matter, you know, that this virus does not care who you voted for. It doesn't care if you live in a red county or a blue county in Wisconsin. It's going to affect all of us regardless of our ideology. And so I think one of the larger ethics concerns here is, what do we do to our communities and our sense of solidarity when we lay these partisan arguments onto everything? So in this case, it was a corporation that made a decision that a video was providing misinformation during a public health crisis. I just struggle to see why that's a left or right issue.
Well, thank you so much for providing your insights, Kathleen Bartson Culver from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a great chat.
That was Kathleen Bartson Culver, the director for the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. Earlier, you heard from Stephen Overly, a technology reporter for Politico. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Coming up next, we hear from film contributor Dave Larson. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. So, how many movies or series have you been watching since spending more time at home? Since going to the movie theater is not an option and may not be for a long time, most of us are turning to streaming services for entertainment. The motion picture distribution system had been under stress even before the pandemic, but as services like Netflix grow with over 182 million subscriptions worldwide, the future of the traditional film industry and movie theaters post-pandemic is uncertain, to say the least. Even the Oscars have adjusted their criteria to allow streaming-only films for their 93rd Academy Awards. This is just one sign of change for the film industry. And to discuss more about the future of movies, I'm joined by film contributor Dave Larson. He starts by explaining how the current situation has impacted his relationship to films.
I was a little late into Netflix and Amazon Prime. I began enjoying that last year, and what has happened in the world now has definitely given me more time to explore what's out there. I mean, I was aware of it, of course, but now I'm spending a great deal of time catching up on Israeli television shows that I read about somewhere, and movies that are available that never opened in Milwaukee 10 years ago, and the enormous wealth of good, bad and mediocre content, just an unbelievable variety that you could never get, unless you would have a multiplex with 500,000 different screens. And even if such a thing could exist and you bought a pass to it, you could never go from one to the other, conveniently. So it changes the way, the possibility of enjoying the art of motion pictures very dramatically. And at the same time, though, I miss the idea of going to a movie theater. I'm not alone in that either, even though I think going to movie theaters is something that has been somewhat in decline for a number of years now, because of home video, because of the access that we have through the streaming services. So the motion picture distribution system that we've known for 100 some years now has been under duress already, and it's very hard to know where this is going to go. I mean, I certainly would predict that there's a pent-up demand once the world opens up again to go back into movie theaters and see things, but then there's the question of how to do that safely. Are there going to be every other row kept empty? Do people have to wear masks? I mean, do you have to buy your tickets ahead of time? There's one proposal that for ordering concessions, you have to order them online ahead of time, and the staff leaves them at the edge of the counter, kind of like the way some carryout restaurants are working right now. So we're entering into some unknown territory, and as Dr. Fauci said, the virus, to some degree, will decide what we do.
Exactly. And as you mentioned, even after restrictions are relaxed, there still just may be hesitation overall to sit in a theater, even if we're spaced out, we're wearing a mask, but to sit in a theater for hours, breathing in recirculated air, you know? And while we do miss that experience of being in a theater with people, I just question how quickly that power will motivate people to adapt their behaviors, because it will be changed.
Well, maybe there'll be a revival of drive-in movie theaters.
There has been a resurgence of drive-ins, though, that I've seen around the country, even though they're showing not necessarily new releases, but the drive-in movie theaters once again having a moment.
Well, understandable. I mean, it is one way of getting around that. Of course, you know, the drive-in experience is a different kind of thing. It's a first cousin to the movie theater experience in a way. It's its own thing, but it does give you the opportunity to get outside, roll down your windows on a nice day, get some fresh air, and watch a movie. I haven't done that myself since I was in high school, and I don't recall it as being an excellent cinematic experience, given problems with sound and everything else. It's not really the same kind of connoisseurship, maybe, that sitting in an art house somewhere watching a film on the big screen could be, but it is some way of getting people out in public, seeing movies in the way they were, you know, long ago meant to be seen, you know, in public on a larger sized screen.
Yeah, and on the note of the traditional movie theater, do you think they're going to survive? You know, what do you think places like Marcus or AMC or even the small ones of Landmark Theaters here in town or the Oriental, you know, obviously their ecosystems are a little bigger compared to very small independent venues, but much like the studios, the bigger ones will survive, but the smaller ones, that future is questionable.
Well, I certainly fear for small, independently owned local theaters. Fox Bay in the Milwaukee area comes to mind, Avalon Theater, some of these beautiful historic locations that have been functioning quite well in recent years. I would say they're in danger. I think that, again, you know, I just hope that the pandemic recedes in such a way that, you know, a year from now, we won't be having the same discussion. So much of what's going to happen is unpredictable right now. So if movie theaters can remain locked up, lights out, closed for, you know, month after month after month, can they get back on their feet again? I mean, the Marcus chain, I'm sure, could be a great blow to them, but they could be refunctioning. Perhaps the Oriental Theater, part of the Milwaukee Film Network, heavily endowed with donations, they might be able to. Other places, I don't know. But I think to me, the final thing is that there will remain a desire, at least by many people, to go to movie theaters to see movies. Whether that desire can be safely met, whether people will feel comfortable doing this, again, is something that epidemiology and medical science would have more of the answers to than a film buff at this point.
Right. And obviously the studio and movie industry economic ecosystem is taking a hit. You know, we're seeing 2020 as a year of pretty much lost revenue, especially coming up on summer movie releases where some of the biggest things like the new James Bond or Black Widow are postponed and moved. So much like other things that this shutdown and safer at home is exposing, do you think this period is showing any unsustainable or negative qualities of the nature of the film industry right now that could be changed on the other side of this?
Well, I suppose the traditional film industry, and they're doing this. I mean, they have released a few films that were intended for theaters on streaming platforms. So are they going to, of necessity, have to go in this direction? I mean, if movie theaters, by and large, remain unable to open or unable to service a large number of people at the same time, what if we have a situation, for example, where the main theater at the beautiful Oriental Theater can only have 20 people at a time per film? Is that economically sustainable over time? you know, these are very serious questions. And of course, the studios in Hollywood, so-called, might, you know, have to resort to releasing their films in a streaming setting more and more if movie theaters can't reopen. That's not what they want to do, obviously, but what other choice can there be if the pandemic holds on?
Right, and for the first time, streamed films are going to be eligible for the Oscars. So when we think about the fall and winter award seasons this coming year, how do you think that will be handled? I mean, I kind of see a loss of enthusiasm all around for things like that.
Right. Well, they've modified the rules to this extent that a film that would have been theatrically released that was intended for that purpose can be eligible if circumstances don't allow it to be theatrically released. So normally the rule was that a movie had to run for 7 days in a commercial theater in Los Angeles County to be eligible for an Academy nomination. They've also modified it to expand this to other cities. Now a movie can be screening for 7 days in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Miami, and Atlanta, in addition to LA. So they're loosening things at the edges, but I don't think that this rule change is really addressing the looming question that would have been posed to the industry even if COVID-19 had never happened. The changing way that movies are distributed, the changing ways that people in large numbers want to watch or consume motion pictures. I mean, this has been happening for a number of years now, and certainly if I were an investor, I wouldn't put money into building any more multiplexes. I'm hopeful that many of the theaters that exist now can sustain themselves in some way, but I don't think that it's going to be a growth industry. I think the growth area is quite obviously online. Netflix has over 182 million paid subscriptions worldwide. 69 million of them are here in the U.S. So this is very formidable.
Definitely. And with the switch to streaming, as you mentioned, some studios released what would have been theater releases right onto a streaming platform. And there was also a move to have an even shorter period of time between rental and then direct to a streaming service. So do you think the audience is just going to demand more things like this going forward?
Well, I think the audience has come to expect having, you know, countless opportunities for entertainment without leaving your home. This was happening when people could go to and fro freely. So the arc is going in that direction. And again, you know, I keep insisting, you know, as I talk to people, that really most people don't want to spend their entire life sitting at home. And no matter how well equipped your home might be, no matter how large of a screen you have, no matter how many subscription services you subscribe to, we're not, you know, made that way as human beings. I mean, most of us have a social impulse or dimension. Most of us do like to get outside. Most of us do like to meet people. Most of us have a desire to be with other people, sharing an experience of some kind. And unless you invite, you know, your 20 friends and crowd into your family room and watch Netflix together, that's not even quite the same thing really as going out, getting out there, doing something. So I think the human need, the very real human need for something like going to a movie theater or a concert hall or to attend a live theater performance of some kind, it's going to be there. But how accessible this can be is the unanswered question right now.
Right. Well, in the meantime, do you have any recommendations of a film to watch while we're all being safer at home with endless streaming options?
Oh, what have I been watching lately? I've been catching up on a number of things, you know, favorites from the past. I wrote an article on pandemic movies, you know, Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film from about 2011. Well, it was remarkably apt in the way it predicted something not unlike COVID-19. In the film, things got much, much worse than they have right now, and hopefully reality won't follow the lead of that film. So I've been watching things like that, great car chase movies like Bullet or The French Connection, revisiting some of my favorite horror films. So, yes, I've been kind of, you know, reflecting back on movies that I wrote about and saw. And I've been, you know, looking for things on BritBox and things on Netflix that I haven't seen before. You know, I've been very, very enamored of a Spanish-language telenovela called High Seas. So I'm just, you know, serendipitously, oh, that looks interesting. And I don't think I'm alone in doing that. I mean, it's just... especially if you're, you know, getting it for free, what are you doing but, worst case scenario, wasting an hour of your time? And rewatching The Irishman again, this is a great film that was under-recognized, I think, by the Academy Awards, probably because it was coming out of a streaming service and not out of the traditional Hollywood spigot. And it's a three-hour-plus movie. Might have been kind of an uncomfortable thing in a movie theater, but the format of streaming allows you, okay, I'm going to pause here, you know, do something else and come back to it in an hour. And this is one of the advantages that, of course, home streaming has over the movie theater experience, that you can actually do big things in more digestible units of time.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining me remotely today, and I look forward to, if not to the next time we talk, to the next time we can share the studio.
I hope we can do that soon.
Dave Lurson is our film contributor and the arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express. You can find all of our past conversations with him at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Julian Haida join me in producing Like Effect each week with help from our executive producer, Becky Mortensen. We also heard from Susan Bentz and Emily Files from the WUWM News team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reevy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.